We're ready for 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 13. We're finishing up Paul's discussion as far as pay for those who are religious workers. Last time we talked about the fact that the Old Testament gave instructions when the ox was treading out the grain that it was not to be muzzled. The Gentiles would muzzle the ox. God said in the Old Testament law that was not to be true for the Jewish people. And then as you get to 1 Corinthians 9:13, he once again introduces another argument. He's gone through argument after argument after argument, and now he says this. Again, 1 Corinthians 9:13. Know ye not that they that minister about sacred things eat of the things of the temple, and they that wait upon the altar have their portion with the altar? When you go back and you start looking at history, biblical history, the law of Moses, you go back and you look at secular history, what people did, and even now, as far as some of the pagans, you find that people have been compensated when they were religious workers. The Jews, they had a responsibility in that area for the Jewish priests, Numbers chapter 18, verses 18 through 32. But you also find that the pagan priests in first century, and Corinth certainly had a number of pagan priests, when people brought the offerings, then of course the priests would have been paid for their services through those offerings. If the Corinthians wanted to argue against paying Paul or paying some of the preachers, they simply had to look at their culture. And their culture taught them day in and day out that religious workers were paid. Paul's already kind of gone through several illustrations. He's talked about the evangelist being paid. He's talked about the soldier being paid, the plowman, the thresher, the vineyard worker. And then, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the animals all being cared for. And then the Corinthians might have looked at those and said, okay, you've covered all these things, and we grant that all those people get paid. They deserve pay, but what about church workers? You've not specifically said anything about religious workers. So Paul talks about the people who serve at the altar. That, of course, would be a reference to those who officiated as priests. The Corinthians, having had some exposure to the Jewish people, and certainly with the exposure to pagans, they would have known that the priests helped take care of the temple, prepare and offer sacrifices, and then, of course, even do some cleanup work. When you look at the word which is translated labor or work, it does describe labor. You find that in some other places, for example, Matthew chapter 7 and verse 23 and Matthew chapter 21 and verse 28, and it is here a present tense verb. We've got another couple key words. One of those would be sacred. That's translated holy in the King James translation. Paul used that same term over in the book of 2 Timothy, 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 15, to talk about the sacred writings. There is some discussion when Paul talked about the sacred things. Was he saying that the pagans had sacred temples? Well, he would not have been looking at that from that perspective necessarily, but he might have recognized that, at least in the minds of the pagans, that their areas were sacred, that their areas were holy, that their areas were special because they were devoted to their deities. You sometimes have people, Jesus, remember the story he told in Luke chapter 16, I believe it's verses 1 through 8, about the dishonest steward? Jesus talked about this fellow who adjusted the books, and the Lord said that that steward acted wisely. Do we sometimes use bad or negative examples to communicate a good point? Can you think of some illustrations? We use, especially with kids, we use a negative illustration to communicate a positive point. Can you demonstrate that? Well, what about when there is a loss of life? You think, for example, about a child who is careless on the road and loses his life. Parents will sometimes point to that and say, look at that example. Not that we want you to follow that, but we can learn something from that. There are times where we use bad examples, and this might be a case of where Paul is appealing to something that he doesn't approve of, but at least the principle, he's able to take that and he's able to extract from that the teaching that religious workers are paid. I think there's another practical point here as well. When you think about this, Paul is able to look at the secular priests, the secular religions, the false religions, the false deities, and so forth, and he's able to take from that a practical point. When it comes to the Christian life, there are all kinds of spiritual lessons to teach, and we can find a spiritual lesson in just about anything. Long ago, I had a teacher who gave me some of the best advice. He said, see life sermonically. That is, look at life through a spiritual lens. And this is really valuable if you're trying to teach kids or grandkids. You see things out there, and you can make spiritual points of application. Use life to teach people religious truths. And it takes a little while to maybe become really proficient in that. Everybody gets better at that if they try. But there are all kinds of things. When you look at Jesus, he's picking out things. He talks about harvest. He talks about seeds. He talks about vineyards. He talks about people in various occupations. He takes things from everyday life. And, I mean, you think about the woman at the well, and he talks about living water. So a lot of times, especially as we're dealing with youth, there are plenty of illustrations out there. We just need to try to wrap our mind around it and offer a spiritual point of application. I'll stop there and see if there's anything that you want to add or ask based on what we've said thus far. Tim?
Sometimes we have to teach them lessons with spiritual examples so that we're hoping at least that they'll live their lives good morally.
Yeah.
Because we tie those two things, morals, good morals, and spiritual things together.
Yeah. People will look for that. If there's an act of kindness, if parents still have kids in the home, they will point to that and say, that's a good thing to do, or maybe it's a negative example, and they will say, that's not what you want to do. And a lot of people do that, and that's a perfectly good thing to do, but Christians can hopefully take that one step further and actually make a spiritual point. This is not only good, this is not only right, this is not only true, but this is what we find consistent with God's word. This is how we want to live as a Christian. So we want to step it up to the next level, so to speak. Very good. Anybody else? Mom?
Well, back in Illinois, maybe a week or two before the junior-senior prom, they'd have a mock car accident with supposedly victims to make the juniors and seniors think about prom night, that, you know, and go out and have a good time, but don't get souped up on alcohol and then drive, because you might not come home.
Yeah, the world does that in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it's an advertisement on radio, TV. Sometimes it's a visual item. They're looking to either preserve life, or they're looking to help young people avoid problems. All good things. But hopefully the Christian takes that to that next level and says there's also a spiritual dimension to this. Is that it? Okay, let's see what else we've got. We got another key word, and that's going to be the word translated temple. And that's kind of interesting. If you were to make a guess, when you look at the word temple, where do you think you would find it mostly used in the New Testament? What books? Huh?
Old Testament.
That's true. I was thinking New Testament, though, but that's a good answer if you're going to look at that as far as the entire Bible. If we narrow that down a little bit, where do you think you're going to find the word temple used mainly in the New Testament?
Hebrews.
Well, you will find at least some references to it there, but the actual word temple. Yeah, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. A lot of things are happening at the temple. What about the book of Acts? Yes, you're also going to have some references there, especially in the early chapters. But then after you get through Acts, after you get through Matthew through Acts, the word temple, it doesn't disappear, but it's used a lot less. Might that indicate something to you?
It's not the main place.
Yeah. Christians realize, and the New Testament writers also recognize the fact, and reminded Christians, I think, that you are the temple. We've already seen that in this particular book. So it's kind of interesting that Christians would gather there as a meeting place. That was already a place that was built. A lot of people coming there. It was very convenient, very useful for a lot of different reasons. But that word just sort of disappears off the pages of the New Testament, unless you're going to come to a book like Hebrews, where there are references back to the Jewish temple to make a point. So that is kind of an interesting point as you start reading through the New Testament. The Bible says, Christians tell us through Acts chapter 17 and verse 24, that God does not dwell in temples made with hands. The church as a building is not a building. It's not a holy place. The church, of course, would be the people. In the middle of this verse, 1 Corinthians 9:13, you have a term which is translated wait. That word means to sit steadily beside. Now, that's kind of an interesting word, and it kind of reminds you of some jobs where somebody is on call. Anybody ever have a job where you're on call, or you ever work with somebody who was on call? In the medical community, sometimes there's that Gary school system. Sometimes you're going to be on call for various things. Trace, yeah, you've gone through that too. Sometimes in automotive, if you've got a plant that's running 24/7, you're not going to be living at the plant, but you perhaps will be on call. Yeah, there were definitely some long hours. That's Paul's point when he talks about the people who wait when it comes to the religious work, that they do not have a typical job, and that would be one more reason to compensate them, because they are accessible at various times. If you're going to be a religious worker, you do sometimes get some odd calls. They can come in literally at all hours of the day. Now, things were set up a little differently 2,000 years ago. People didn't have email. They couldn't text. They couldn't call. But still, there were things that did come up. You have at the end of the verse, 1 Corinthians 9:13, the text says there's a verb which is translated, they have their portion. The King James translates that, they are partakers. That word's not found anywhere else in the New Testament, and it is a word which means that the people have the right to share in the offerings given to God. The ASV says that they are to eat the things of the temple. King James says they live of the things of the temple. So in the Old Testament system, you had priests who were able to partake of the meat. They had their portion. Pagans also did a similar thing today. You have, going back about 100 or so years in this country, there were some preachers who were paid with livestock. Sometimes people would say, you know, here's a chicken, come on over for lunch, take home a chicken, or we'll give you sheep or something else. And people have been paid in all kinds of different ways. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down to 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 14? Brian, to you.
Back to Eli's sons.
We're going to get to him.
Okay, cool.
So we're not quite there yet, but very good. Anybody else? All right, let's pick up with 1 Corinthians 9:14. Even so did the Lord ordain that they that proclaim the gospel should live of the gospel. Paul has already gone through several arguments as far as why preachers should be paid, and this is where he brings things to a conclusion. He says Jesus ordained that preachers should live of the gospel. One source suggested ordained refers to one of the special orders Jesus gave when sending out the disciples, the limited commission back there in Matthew chapter 10, verse 10. That very well could be true. I don't know. The Corinthians were taught some things about what Jesus said that we don't have. And this would be one example of that. At some point in his life, Jesus did talk about the people who preach being paid. You've got some other places that use the word ordain in the New Testament. That word is used in Luke chapter 3 and verse 13. There in Luke 3:13, it's translated appointed. It's also used in Acts chapter 18 and verse 2. Acts 18:2 translates it commanded. Acts chapter 20 and verse 13. Acts 20:13 says appointed versus ordained. 1 Corinthians 7:17 and also 1 Corinthians 11:34, set in order. Here, the definition is set in order, direct command. When you start looking around, you find that a lot of different religious groups ordain people. If you are a preacher within the church and you're talking to somebody, they probably are going to be surprised if they ask about your ordination and you say, no, I am not an ordained preacher, because that's what people expect. And when it comes to that, they're thinking, as far as the various denominations, that you have received authority from someone, or you have received authority from some religious body, and that's Old Testament thinking. If you go back to the Old Testament, you find Exodus chapter 28 as well as Exodus chapter 29. The Old Testament priests were ordained. There was a set-up ceremony which truly set them apart. But now, there is no practice for ordaining people when we think about New Testament Christianity. We don't get, if we're going to preach, our authority from any earthly organization. It comes from God and His Word. Now, that doesn't sit very well with some people. In fact, in preparation for tonight's class, I went and did a little looking on the web, not extensively, but there's actually a website which is getordained.org. Now, if you were to look at getordained.org, you'd find some interesting things. I pulled off a couple of short statements from people who really appreciate the work that they're doing. One lady said, my old church wasn't fulfilling me. I got ordained to kind of direct my own spiritual journey. Here was the part that got me. The extra cash from officiating was a nice bonus! Exclamation mark. There are some people who want to be ordained because it makes them feel important, perhaps. There are some other people who are looking for some extra money. Another fellow said, I got ordained online to start a ministry up here in Maine. $40 later, and my life was changed. I'd recommend to anyone feeling lost. So that's not even a degree mill where you're paying a good bit of money, but $40 for the ordination certificate. If you were to look at the site, it says, regardless of religious preference or gender or sexual orientation or nationality or any other identifying factor. You want to guess how many people have been ordained through this site? Well, yeah, a lot would be a good answer, a truthful answer. But anybody want to take a stab at the number? I was astounded. 20 million. 20 million people have been ordained.
I have a friend that was ordained.
Huh?
I have a friend that was ordained.
Yeah.
But she did it because there's a lot of religious people in town that wanted to get married or have somebody officiated a funeral, but they didn't want to do it in that church.
Yeah, there are some small towns where maybe there are not too many churches, there is no church, or they don't want to do a wedding, so there are some people as sort of a public service that will do that. And we can be, I think, a little more appreciative of people who take that tack, that approach. But there are some people who are just looking for some extra cash, and they want to run around with ordained or reverend after the name. And it's really sad, and it confuses people. Mom, and then we'll take Gary.
Yes, I actually have a family member that her son-in-law wanted his dad to marry him and his bride. And so the father sent in and got a certificate and was ordained, so he performed the wedding.
There have been a lot of people who have done it for that reason, and it can be a little bit of a difficulty. I know I had a wedding in Ohio some years back. Ohio has some really strange rules. I've seen a preacher post recently some information that he's gone through the same thing. Somebody asked him to come and perform a wedding in Ohio, and it was like, how on earth do I get a certificate that says I'm ordained? He's a faithful preacher in the church, and it is kind of strange some of the legal hoops that you have to jump through, but this is a big deal for a lot of folks.
In the state of Indiana, don't you have to be ordained to perform a wedding? Well, ordained according to the state?
Right? I think that there is, but when I went through that, it was pretty much you are working with a local congregation, they're paying you, therefore we're going to qualify you as ordained. It was pretty cut and dry. There was really nothing to it. But yes, I do think that Indiana has a ordination requirement, but very simple to fulfill.
Yeah, if you don't have that certificate, you're not supposed to be performing marriage legally, right?
Yeah, Ohio is really strict on that. But I think Indiana is as well. It's just that Indiana's bar to meet that is comparatively low compared to Ohio. Marcia?
My brother-in-law married his son and daughter-in-law. They wanted him to, and it was an outdoor wedding in a really beautiful park, and that's in Illinois. Illinois is really lax on that. And then after their second child was born, my brother-in-law gave his daughter-in-law a fright and said, you know, I don't think you're really married because I'm not sure I could have done that.
Yeah. People will get it for various reasons. There have actually been some people who got it so they could, quote-unquote, baptize somebody. You don't read about anything like that in the New Testament. I mean, anybody can baptize another person. There's no legal requirement that I'm aware of in any state which says that you must be an ordained member to baptize somebody. But once again, it comes back to some people like letters after the name or something about them is going to be distinctive compared to anybody else. But after you've hit 20 million people, it just doesn't seem, I guess, that special to me. Yeah, I was thinking that too. That's a pretty good sum of money. Isn't the population of the U.S. around 300 million?
328.
Okay, so if you are at 20%, I mean, that's interesting. It will not be very long until we've got 10% of America in the ordination category. I mean, that's just shocking. But again, so if you come across somebody who says that they are ordained, don't be surprised and realize that that could have come from someplace like getordained.com. I'm sure that's not the only one. That it? Or another comment on that? Okay, let's go back and see what we've got towards the end of this verse, 1 Corinthians 9:14. The ASV and the King James translate the thought, live of the gospel. The New King James, NIV, New American Standard say, live from the gospel. And the preposition that's used, it means that you are living out of the gospel. Priests lived out of the temple in the sense that preachers live out of the gospel. Reference to compensation, live is a present tense verb. Congregations have a responsibility to offer some kind of remuneration to those who work with them. Preachers should receive a livable salary. One source said this. I like the quote. I think that there's some wisdom here. He said, Preachers should be made comfortable, not rich. They should receive so much as to keep their minds from being harassed with cares and their families from want or lack, not so much as to lead them to forget their dependence on God or on the people. Probably the true rule is that they should be able to live as the mass of the people among them whom they labor live, that they should be able to receive and entertain the poor and be willing to do it, and so that the rich also may not despise them or turn them away from their dwelling. There have been some cases where congregations and preachers have really been mismatched. If you have a preacher who is really poor and he's working with a congregation that has a lot of extremely wealthy members, is that probably going to be a good fit? It just is going to come with some problems. And then you can have a real rich preacher. I know a guy who was investing in oil wells. And he didn't make much of that as far as talking about it. But he was a very, very wealthy individual. And they just had a ton of money. But if you're the rich preacher and you're working with a congregation that's poor, especially overseas, how's that going to work out? it's not going to work out too great either. So ideally, there's going to be pretty much a balance, and that just seems to work out well in most places. You've got, at this point, six arguments for the correctness of paying preachers, and that forms the basis for what Paul has to say in the rest of the chapter. He has to prove to the Corinthians that paying a preacher is right before he talks about his foregoing that right. And that's really what he's headed towards. He wants to talk about the fact that he did not use this right, even though that was available to him. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down to verse 15 of 1 Corinthians 9? Okay, let's see what he says there. He says, but, notice the contrast, I have used none of these things, talking about the right to have pay. And I write not these things, that it may be so done in my case. For it were good for me rather to die than that any man should make my glorying void. Okay, once again, Paul has made it crystal clear that paying the preacher is right. Here, he continues to talk about that subject, but he does make a subtle change. In the previous verses, he used the plural. He talked about we and our. You see that back in verses 4, 5, 10, 11, and 12. But now he's going to focus on himself and what he did. He said to the Corinthians, I have used how many of these things?
None.
None. If you were to restate that, I have taken how much money from you?
None.
Zero. Not a dime. Not a nickel. Not a penny. When Paul expresses that point, he uses the perfect tense. What do we know about the perfect tense? You say something in the past and that it keeps on going. So when Paul says, I have used none of these things, I've not taken any money from you, what would have been true about financial remuneration from the Corinthians? Had he ever gotten anything? He had never taken a single cent from these Christians. So he was definitely not in the habit of taking money from this congregation, seems like some others as well. He did not want any kind of church check from Corinth. Paul had given up his right along with some other things. We saw that back in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 13. And then if we were to skip ahead over to the 2 Corinthians letter, 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 3, he said sometimes, I will do that so I'm not going to be a stumbling block. I'm going to do that so there's nothing that's going to somehow be an impediment to my work. I don't want people to have a basis to complain. And this was one of the ways that he did it when it came to the Corinthians and money. Paul was entitled to support, so it was important for this, and you begin to see this really at the middle of verse 15. If you go through all this discussion, I'm entitled to support, you know, I've not taken support ever. Some people at this juncture might have been thinking, what about Paul? Oh, he's saying all this stuff, what?
To get ready for a donation.
Yes. And it might look like that, that he's kind of setting them up thinking, okay, I've not taken any money up to this point. Therefore, after all the things I've done with you and for you, now it's time to put you on the hook and now it's time to get a church check. But Paul dealt with that potential charge by saying he still didn't want any money from the Corinthians. Now, if you were reading this letter, and you get to this point in the letter where Paul has gone through all this stuff about money. I deserve it. I've never taken it. And now I still don't want your money. What would you be thinking about the guy?
What's the deal?
Yeah, you would be a little curious. You'd be kind of thinking, what's your motivation? Why have you taken all the time to lay all these things out? Well, let's pause the thought there for just a second. Religion and money. Have those two things often gone together in the past and even now? Yes. And how have we seen that play out sometimes? Yes. Yeah. You see that oftentimes on television. People have, you know, these big ministries that they have created, and they're begging for money so that they can build a bigger building, they can have an airplane, they can build a theme park, or who knows what, but a lot of requests for cash. Well, you find this also in the Bible. Brian, we're going to foot back to you, or I can take this, whichever way you want to go, as far as Eli's sons.
I am there.
Okay. Do you want to...
Well, my point with it was that Eli had heard that they were sleeping with the women that gathered at the temple, or tabernacle, and they wanted raw meat, so their servants would come and stick the fork in before the sacrifice was done. The people said, don't do that. Wait till it's sacrificed. They said, if you don't give it to me now, we'll take it by force. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they had a right to eat the food, but it was still controlled by rules that God had set in place.
Yeah.
So that would still, I think, a principle there would be, you know, the preacher has a right to be paid, but there's got to be some common sense to it.
Yes. Exactly right. And they didn't use that. They didn't want to use that. It was pretty much, this is the meat that we think that we deserve, or at least this is the meat that we want. And they use religion for personal gain. There are people today who do that same kind of thing. And it was wrong for the sons of Eli. It's still wrong today. If you were to go back and look at that information in 1 Samuel chapter 2, you would find in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 12, the Bible says, they did not know the Lord. Isn't that an interesting statement? It's also fascinating to consider that today from the standpoint of people who use religion for gain. They do not know God. But they took food, 1 Samuel chapter 2, verses 13 through 17, that they were not entitled to. And then the reference that Brian alluded to is 1 Samuel 2 and verse 22, that they became sexually involved with some of the Hebrew women. It looks like they seduced some of the young women who were working at the tabernacle. When you look at religion, you do find that people have been fleeced sometimes. You also do find that there's been sexual sin that has involved religion. People have done some awful things in the name of God, or supposedly in accordance with Scripture. So those kinds of things, when we see them, they're wrong. They've always been wrong, but they are by no means new. Well, Paul didn't want anything to do with those kinds of things. He wanted to be free from scandal so his ministry would not be damaged in some way, and that should be the way that we try to seek to live out our lives as well. One other quick point here, as far as a quick little paragraph, and then we'll see if there's anything that you want to say or add. You also have the references to Paul dying. You really see a lot of emotion packed into these words. He says, in my case, and he also uses the word die, then too we have the word glory. In other words, Paul says, I've chosen my course. I'm entitled to money. I don't want the money. And if I can't live in this way, if I can't refuse the money, I would just rather die. Now, if you've got a guy telling you that, what are you thinking about him? One of two things, I think.
Very passionate about
Yeah, either the guy is really sincere, he's really passionate. I mean, this is definitely the course that he's going to pursue. That's option number one. Option number two would be what?
Crazy.
He's crazy. So you have to really kind of come down on one side of the fence or the other. But Paul felt like, and this is really what he's saying, he felt like death was preferable than taking money from the Corinthians. Have you ever seen a case where somebody said, I will not take your money? I refuse to take your money. Maybe somebody had taken you out for lunch and they were trying to buy you lunch and you said, no, we're not going to do that. You know, you pay your bill, I'll pay my bill. I just refuse to take that. Or somebody helped us out, or we helped somebody out and there was an offer for cash. We offered money because of the service that we received, or the shoe was on the other foot. And again, it was an absolute no. And that's kind of what Paul is saying to the Corinthians. You have the word void being used in the ASV, and that further affirms that Paul did not want things to change. He said, I do not want to take money because I want to be able to glory. And that doesn't mean that he was going to engage in some kind of sinful boasting. It simply means that he wanted to be able to say, I have not taken any money from you. That tells me a little bit as far as the false teachers that were trying to undermine Paul. These guys, these characters, must have been a constant thorn in Paul's side, because he took some radical steps. He did some extreme things to keep things on track as far as his work and try to nullify the charges that were made against him. So, he really went to the mat when it came to the Corinthians and not accepting any money, but he did not want anything from them. You have sometimes people today saying something similar. I don't want to be indebted to you. You could do this for me. You could give me this money. But if you do that, I'm going to feel indebted to you somehow. And maybe that was also part of Paul's point. Tim, to you.
Not knowing Paul personally, but probably part of the reason he said those things was because he didn't want anybody, including the Corinthians or anybody else, to think that he was using God to make money. He wanted God to get the glory because God is God. That, you know, he was trying to help humanity the way God wanted him to, not to make money.
Yeah, that's true. Tells you a little bit about his motivation and his heart. Anybody else? Brian?
I think in Acts 18 is where Paul shows up at
Corinth
alone, and then Silas and Timothy join him there. I'm wondering, when you read through Acts 9, at least in verse 12, you mentioned that it's plural about the right for a preacher to be paid, and now he's switching to singular through the rest of the chapter. Makes me wonder if maybe Silas and Timothy didn't take that same attitude about it.
It's possible. It's possible.
Yeah.
We don't know, but it is a good question.
It for the switch to single?
No.
Okay.
Mom, to you?
I was just going to say maybe he had a bad experience earlier in another church. And this is what formed his mind about this church, that he definitely didn't want to take anything.
I'm sure at least at some point he took some heat from some people. I think if most guys preach long enough, they're going to have somebody say, you're in it for the money. I mean, that's just, people have said, look, there's no work that's associated with preaching. You don't earn your money. A lot of people have come up with something similar to that. And I think most preachers generally would respond, if that's true, if you really believe that, come on in, the water's fine. You know, there's always room for others. And people generally don't want to do that. But it's like anything else. The grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. You can look at a job and think, wow, you really have it easy. You can see the supervisor who seems to be sitting in the chair and not doing anything, you know, but maybe answering a couple phone calls and answering a couple emails. But if you get on the other side of the fence, you begin to find that things may not be quite as they seem. Anybody else? Okay, let's see what we've got in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 16. He says, for if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of. For necessity is laid upon me, for woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. Now this passage is going to be parallel to what we find in verse 17, and it tells us why Paul wanted to preach. It was not because of money. We know that from what's been said earlier in the chapter. You also find that when Paul talks about preaching, this is a present tense verb. So this was something that he chose as far as a lifelong occupation, and he says, I didn't become a preacher so I could what? So I could
boast
or brag or glory. Are there some people who like to boast and brag, especially when it comes to the work? I'm the best. Look at me. No one has ever been able to do this as well as I can. We find that a lot sometimes with individuals. But Paul became, as you look at 1 Corinthians 9:16, he says, I became a preacher for what reason? Not to glory, but I became a preacher out of necessity. That is a key word. Jesus handpicked him. Well, if the Lord handpicks you for a particular work, in this case being an apostle and preacher, does that, I mean, do you have any choice in the matter? Yes. But as you weigh your options there, are you really motivated to choose one or the other as far as doing it or not doing it?
You have to make a decision.
Well, you do have to make a decision. But having Jesus personally appear to you, you're struck blind for a period of time, and when things get straightened out, do you have kind of an incentive to head down that road and be a preacher? Certainly to be a Christian, but also to be a preacher. One source said, and I like this quote, he says, if a man boasts of his own behavior, he should do so only insofar as his life is lived in dependence on God and in responsibility to him. In other words, if you're going to boast, you better be sure that you're on good ground. For in the last analysis, the Christian can never boast about himself, but only in his Lord. Now, this is kind of interesting when you think about Paul's preaching. He makes the point over in Galatians 1 and verse 23 that he had previously tried to destroy the faith. Now, he's the one who's trying to promote it. Paul, of course, had free will. He could have refused the Lord's invitation. He chose to obey. He was someone who had a strong sense of responsibility that Tim alluded to earlier. But that's not true for every person who becomes a preacher. You think that there are some individuals, they, as they look at preaching, just like some of the jobs, they say, well, I'll give this a try and see how it goes. I'm not sure I'm going to like it. I'm not sure this is going to be a really good thing, but let me just kind of try. Well, is that sinful? No, but is that maybe the best attitude? Probably not either, for a lot of things, but especially when it comes to preaching. Or you have some of the people, and this grates on my nerves a little bit. Somebody says, well, you know, I was working for the garbage company for a little while. Nothing wrong with that. You can be a garbage collector. That's a perfectly fine job. We need that service, and it is an honorable profession. Honorable profession. But somebody says, I just got tired of the stench, and I decided to preach for a while. Well, you know, that pains me a little bit. I mean, it just sounds like, you know, I might get a job at Walmart, or I might do this, or I might do some preaching. I do hear that from people from time to time, and it just, like I say, maybe it's just a personal thing, but it kind of grates on my nerves a little bit, especially when you look at Paul and his attitude. He says, the using the verb, it's laid upon me, that is a present tense verb. As Paul looked at his life, he gets up in the morning, and he pictures himself as someone who is thinking, I have got to preach. You know, this is a responsibility that I have. God has given me this stewardship, and this is something that I need to do. It is the same word that's it's translated pressed in Luke chapter 5 and verse 1. It's almost as if Paul felt some pressure to preach. One source said preaching was Paul's whole life, and he could no more stop doing it than he could stop breathing. Another key word is going to be necessity. That word is found in chapter 7, verses 26 and 37, and here it has the sense of compulsion. Paul knows that he's got a significant responsibility. In fact, what's another key word here in verse 16? He says, what is going to happen to me if I don't preach the gospel? He said,
whoa,
an important word. Paul believed that calamity would be his lot in life if he did not fulfill his mission. A lot of commentators understand woe as the loss of eternal salvation, eternal condemnation in hell, and that very well could be possible. Paul's conscience would have followed him. All the things that he had done, all the things that he had experienced, the great change, he felt like he simply had to preach. When you look at that word, which is rendered woe, which used over 40 times in the New Testament, it carries the ideas of sorrow, judgment, punishment, and warning. Here Thayer said it means divine penalty threatens me. Then one other quick quote, and then we'll stop for hands. A man whose heart is not in the ministry and who would be as happy in any other calling is not fit to be an ambassador of Jesus Christ. Unless his heart is there and he prefers that to any other calling, he should never think of preaching the gospel. And I think that's a good quote. If you are not really interested in preaching, it should not be something that you use. There are some people who have looked at it. I need some money. I need some extra income, so I'll go out and preach on the weekend. Well, you know, yes, you might need some extra money, but if that's really your motivation for going out and preaching, it's not a good motivation. So the people who get involved with preaching, hopefully they really have a heart for it, and church work is something that, you know, they think about on a daily basis. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down a little bit more? Steve, to you?
One cross reference could be Jeremiah 20:9.
Yep.
It says, then I said, I will not make mention of him, nor speak any in his name. But his word was in my heart like a burning fire, shut up in my bones. I was weary of holding it back, and I could not.
Yeah. What are some things in life that people feel a strong urge to do or convey or say? I mean, it's like they just can't contain it.
Giving family advice.
Okay. There might be some advice givers. They just have to go around, maybe with family, maybe with others, that they just have to go ahead and kick in their 2 cents. But that's true.
Mothers are good at that.
Okay, mothers are good at that. So mom always has something to say. Right?
If you had knowledge of, say, a bomb threat, a legitimate concern like that, did you feel an obligation to tell people?
Yeah. Yeah. If there is some kind of threat, then people want to get the word out and communicate that to the police or whoever that might be, that this is urgent. We have to share this information. What else? Information where people feel like they have a strong compulsion to share it.
House is on fire.
All right. There could be an emergency. Kind of goes back to what Brian was talking about a minute ago, but we've got to communicate to neighbors that our house is on fire. They need to be wary, and anybody that's in our house as well, we've got to let them know that they've got to get out.
I think too, in a positive way, if the congregation's been praying about something for a long time, and you find out God's delivered, tell everybody that.
Yeah.
Get the word out.
Yeah. There is that?
I think good police officers and firefighters are that way. If they really care about the people they serve, they try to warn those people about things that can hurt them or even kill them. And, you know, a lot of times they'll do it on their own time. Officers will get a day or two off from work and they'll either go to meetings and tell people, or if they get a chance to get on the tube or the radio, or, you know, same thing with firefighters. You know, make your home safe. You got little children in there.
Yeah. Healthcare warnings are in the same kind of area. They try to get the word out. They feel passionately about ending a disease, or they feel passionately about spreading information on a medicine that can help people, and they push that information because they feel it passionately. What about a politician who thinks that he or she wants to run because he or she believes that he or she can really better the country? I mean, that's really at the core of who they are. They think, I can get in there and I can make a difference. What do?
Rallies.
They're going to go to rallies. They're going to go maybe house to house, get on radio, get on TV. They want to get out and they want to promote the message. So this was Paul's burning desire as a Christian. He really wanted to preach the gospel. Anybody else? Did I miss a hand? Okay, let's see. We've got about 4 minutes left. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 17. He says, "For if I do this of my own will," that is, if I'm a preacher of my own will, I have a reward. "But if not of mine own will, I have a stewardship entrusted to me." Now, bear in mind, Paul just said, "I'm preaching out of necessity." He was not like the person who said, "Well, you know, I might like to preach, I might not." No, Paul made a deliberate choice when it came to preaching. He was under that divine obligation that we talked about. Now he makes another point. He says, if I became a preacher of my own will, that is, if I decided, I looked at my life and maybe I was doing this. One of my teachers was a golf pro. And he told the class one day, he said, I was out there squatting around the golf ball. And he thought, is this really how I want to spend my life? Anything wrong with being a golf pro? Nope. I mean, not dishonest. Some people like the game of golf, and he apparently was helpful. He could have lived his life in that particular way, but he looked at his life, and he thought, I want to become a preacher. He did. And a very successful preacher ended up teaching other people to preach the gospel. Paul says, if I become a preacher of my own will, like the golf guy, you know, he's headed in one direction, and he chooses to go in a different direction. He says, I would be entitled to what? I'd be entitled to a
reward.
He didn't specify what that is. We simply don't know. But God does seem to bear in mind, as far as what we have here, the motivation for people wanting to preach. But then he flips it around. He says, if preaching the gospel had not been of his own will, and that would have been true in Paul's case, but God had called him, he had responded. Paul said, in this set of circumstances, in the second case, I have what? Then I have a stewardship. I have some responsibilities because God has given something to me. And that is true. The King James says the dispensation of the gospel. Paul's stewardship, one source said, well, we'll squeeze this in two, denotes the apostle's attitude towards the duties of his apostolic office. 1 Corinthians 9:17, Paul used the word to describe the responsibility of preaching the gospel entrusted him by God as a commission from which he would not draw back. When we think about a stewardship, someone has entrusted us. Anybody remember the show about Magnum P.I.? Okay. Who was the guy who was kind of the steward over the big estate? Higgins, wasn't it? All right, Magnum kind of lives there and doesn't always do things quite as Higgins wanted. But Magnum was enjoying that, even though Higgins was the one who was over the stewardship. And you have here Paul kind of comparing himself to Higgins. He was the one who was responsible for the stewardship. So as you look at verse 17, we have a fairly simple case. You have, in most cases, a person doing what he's commanded. He has no reason to boast about it. It's simply, I've been entrusted to do this. And if you're faithful, that is a good thing. We're commanded to be faithful. On the other hand, Paul's making the point that if someone is entitled to do something but freely gives up that entitlement, in this case, Paul did. He didn't accept the preaching from pay. Then there, of course, is a sense in which he can boast about that as well. Anything you want to add or ask as far as a final comment? All right. Looks like 1 Corinthians 9:17 is a good stopping point, so we will end it right there. Thank you.